Hello and welcome to the Miko Bits Show, and I'm your host, Miko Bits. Today, we have Stephen Cho, who actually is the head of play at Mechanism Capital, and they're one of our partners and co-investors, so very happy to have Steve on the show. Welcome to the Miko Bits Show.
Glad to be on, Miko. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it. And definitely known you for quite some time, even before all these crazy crypto days. So really great to find like-minded people in this industry as well. So thank you.
Yeah, wonderful. So, I wanted to start the show today with a bit of an acknowledgement, right? Which is that, you know, the world is at war and, you know, it definitely is a pretty serious and difficult time for a lot of people. So, you know, it's awkward to just jump into the show topic without kind of touching on that and, you know, acknowledging that. So I think I'd like to kind of acknowledge that, you know, if you know, Steve, if you have any words to add to that, that's, you know, absolutely fine. And then we can kind of get into the business of the show.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the opportunity to just provide my thoughts on it. I think that these are very, very rare times in the world, and that, like, overall, like, we have seen skirmishes and different types of conflicts throughout the entire globe, like, based upon just nation states. But I don't think we have seen something to the level where now you have, like, what's considered to be a superpower really kind of imposing their power and their will on another sovereign state. Albeit, however, the consideration is whether they would consider it to be sovereign or not. And I think that's worth a pause, like, just to think about what that means, the gravity of that, what that could potentially mean in the future, given, like, what people have talked about in terms of where these type of things can happen. I think that is definitely something that I think is very rare for this situation. However, I'd say that, like, when you think about just overall nation states and you look at what's happening with technology, one can make the argument that just overall, when you look at the incentives being aligned, there seems to be almost this misalignment between tech and where nation states are currently at right now in the world. And I would say that even further than that, even some of the stuff we're trying to do around sanctions, it is interesting that we use that as a lever now to potentially stop what we consider to be bad actors in a global economy, when in reality, some of those sanctions are actually kind of like, I wonder how much they're actually as potent as they used to be, given the fact that now we have cryptocurrency and new ways to help help either nation states or even circumvent the way that things are done. So again, this is not necessarily a bias either way. It means that there just seems to be a mismatch in where technology is today, how nation states have been formed, and how nation states are using technology and how these things can align incentives again. And this mismatching of incentives, I think, is what's causing more of this conflict, right? Obviously, a power grab by potentially one nation over another nation without really considering the ramifications throughout the world. So my heart goes out to everyone in that conflict on both sides. I think it's really difficult given that the gravity of where we are today, like, you would think that we wouldn't have to spill blood in order to get progress going on within the global economy. But in reality, that's what we're faced with. Yeah.
Yeah. And I totally appreciate the note that you ended on, right? Because in a sense, like, it's a hard line to even approach, in the sense that, like, you know, from the perspective of, you know, what we can do, you know, I think what we can do is, I think we can feel uncomfortable. I think we can feel helpless, you know, and I think, because the thing is people are feeling more than uncomfortable and more than helpless, you know, in out there. So, like, you know, for me, like, yeah. I don't want this to be a show about fixing war using, you know, the games and blockchain and things that we do on a day-to-day basis. Like, I don't want to necessarily do that hard segue where we're like, oh, and we're going to fix it all with the things that, you know, which is
yeah.
For us, right? So I think I appreciate the way you've approached it, because in a way, like, you know, but we do, you know, we do need to kind of, like, conduct the show. So, you know, I think we should go there, right? So we should go into sort of, I'd love to hear a little more about your background. So, you know, let's segue. Like, I think it's, you know, certainly important for us to make that acknowledgement. And, you know, and I think it's also important for us to, you know, help, you know, delve into the topics that the show is focused on. So, you know, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into this.
Yeah. So, interesting enough, I actually got into technology back in, like, 2013. I'd come from IBM, where I had, like, a career over there, and then one day just quit my job and realized that I wanted to actually start in the wonderful world of startups. Like a lot of people that are young that really want to get into the entire startup culture. And that was almost like 5.5 years of my life, specifically within mobile ad technology. That's where I met you. I met Paul and a bunch of other people. And I would say that really just focused on working with game and app developers on trying to improve some of the metrics they look on a daily basis, whether that's engagement or retention or even monetization, but doing it through a mobile ad network that was focused on rewarding users for hitting high score moments or doing achievements within games. So in that 5.5 years, I actually learned quite a bit about mobile, about games, about apps, about their pain points. And in the process of doing that, at the very start of that journey, I also learned this thing about cryptocurrency called Bitcoin. So I'm an old time Bitcoin bull from like 2013. So I've been in crypto for quite some time. And I definitely learned a lot of the bumps and bruises a lot of people did about cryptocurrency. There's a lot of ways to probably make money, but there's also a lot of ways to lose a lot of money too. So I experienced both. And I think a lot of people, luckily I came out somewhat unscathed to be able to kind of enjoy where we are today with what's happening. But yeah, 5.5 years of startups, 2 different startups, both failed miserably. But in those failures, I think what you have is a lot of great learning opportunities. And through those lessons, I just got fortunate enough to have an opportunity to potentially work at Apple. And in that regards, my career at Apple was about 4.5 years. I specifically focused within the App Store. And within the App Store, the area I focused on was our games business, specifically on the team called the business manager team. So our remit of the team was to grow the games business. And that would be, the blocking and tackling of working with some of the biggest free-to-play game developers that I think a lot of people know within the industry. But also to be able to develop and devise several hypotheses about what's going to happen next and how Apple could participate in growing that games business even further in terms of what's the next quantum leap opportunity for Apple. So I had 2 heading in. One was around user-generated content, UGC experiences. So UGC experience would be something like a Roblox or a Minecraft, yeah, or even like a Rec Room. So those were things that I was really passionate about looking at, was how can users get involved in creating the content? Because we all know that creating first-party content is hard. And any studio that's out there trying to build a game or an application where they're always servicing and providing that first-party content, that's just a lot of overhead. So the idea is, why can't the users get more involved in generating the content? I think that's a very lucrative area within what we will probably talk about next, which is the metaverse area. And then the other part is around NFT blockchain. So obviously, since I was in it since 2013, naturally, when I joined Apple in 2017, it was a natural segue into talking internally more about these specific technologies. Not that Apple's leaning in one way or the other, but to at least just explore, make them aware. And another thing is, whenever people say that Apple is leaning in or exploring something, it's funny because it always gets kind of like the news headline, right? But the reality is, we're talking about a company that has a market capitalization in the trillions. You would think that they better be leaning in, exploring everything. They have the resources. So this was an area I was passionate about, something that I was passionate about throughout my entire career. And it wasn't until just lately with NBA Top Shot, I think with Dapper Labs, this was back in I'd say the March timeframe of last year, about this time this year, actually, that I think there was a lot more fascination around what this could potentially do, specifically the NFT side of it. So I was actually the subject matter expert around anything that was NFT related for the App Store, basically being able to be that at least that internal, insightful person that can help out the business, but at the same time, working externally with game and app developers around potentially if they want to do something NFT on the store, what we could potentially do there. So, and then I did that. And then basically I was doing that role for that 4.5 years. And then what I ended up doing was based upon all the different feedback I was getting internally, which really excited me, plus all the insight I was getting externally from all the different people I talked to, all the conversations, it just made it feel natural that my time at Apple had kind of come to a close in a very good way, because I felt like I could do a lot more good on the outside versus being kind of cryptic on the inside to the people that are out there in the developer community. So I decided to resign. And then from there, I joined Mechanism Capital as a general partner, specifically talking about what you alluded to earlier, which is, we have a $100 million gaming fund, and I'm just looking to actualize the metaverse, man. I'm looking for what I really want done on Web3 in a very selfish way, because I have my own thoughts around it. I would love to see some of this actually happen. So, yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that's super exciting. So, you know, before we dive into the metaverse whole hog, like what I would love to kind of ask you is, do you have any advice to mobile developers who are interested in NFT in terms of how they should engage with the Apple App Store, right? Because if they have NFT, like Apple's obviously yeah. interested in like getting their payment, you know, mechanism. So how would you recommend or advise people to approach that?
I think at the end of the day, what I think working with Apple is actually it's interesting because a lot of people I think find it a bit difficult to understand exactly what Apple wants. But the reality is, I don't think it's really about what Apple wants. It's more along the lines of what they believe that users want. And when I think about users, I think about the people that use all the devices. And I still obviously use. I'm very much an Apple fanboy. So my whole thing is like. Using it, when we look at things, we look at from a perspective of what the users want. And even then, it's not just about what the users want. It's what aligns with Apple values. And I think if you have those two things in mind, a user-centric type of product or service that you're offering that will provide value to that user isn't just like a land grab on NFTs, but like a value to the user, but at the same time is aligned with Apple values around what we have around trust, safety, security, privacy. If you have those alignments with us, it's very easy to partner with Apple, I think. It's just that you have to have those pieces. And then when you have those pieces in mind, the question is like, what about NFTs? Should we be mindful about when it comes to the app, to Apple and the App Store? The reality is an NFT, in my opinion, is just another way to show a decentralized ledger that's tokenized on a piece of digital content. That's no different to me than if you had PlayFab on your back end, and you would centralize this gaming company that's free to play would have a centralized ledger of the digital content that Miko you would own, right? There's yeah. nothing different with that. It's just that one is exposed transparently. So I don't think Apple and the App Store probably has a per se issue with you leveraging that technology in terms of NFTs and knowing that that's a technology being implemented. It's how those NFTs are being potentially sold. How those NFTs are probably being traded or how those NFTs are potentially being used or leveraged, right? Just like any piece of digital content, right? So I think all that needs to make sense in that journey. Now, being able to purchase and probably be able to like do something along the lines of purchasing primary sale of an NFT, since it is a digital piece of content, yeah, there's in-app purchase that would typically use to actually facilitate that transaction. And it doesn't have to be the only way to do the transaction, but it should be made available for sale through in-app purchase. I think that is one of the payment methods that should potentially be an option for a developer to be able to use in order to actually transact on the App Store. I think that's probably where a lot of people get it kind of, they're not quite sure how that works. And it's really quite simply that. If it was something that you were just issuing an NFT that was like an identity NFT, and it wasn't really made available for sale anywhere for commerce, it was just something that you issued, I don't think Apple would make you charge an in-app purchase for something that you're not even selling. It's still an NFT though.
Yeah. Well, good. Thanks for that color. You know, obviously we're here to kind of get your views on things. So tell me more broadly, like, you know, about the rise of the metaverse, like what has changed, right? We obviously touched on NFT, right? So how do you see, you know, how do you see this space and, you know, what's new and, you know, how does that change things?
That's a great question. I think we're just scratching the surface on this whole understanding of what really is happening on the internet. And I take a step back because it's so easy to just dive into like one metaverse. In some cases, some of the thought leaders in the space that I really respect, they talk about an open metaverse too. But even if we back up the truck even further, we find out what we're really talking about is what I consider to be the evolution of the internet and what the internet could look like in the next 5 to 10
right.
years.
Right.
And when I look at that next to 5, 10 years, and I think about the internet, I do see some major transformational shifts, right? So one area that I see that's a transformational shift is around hardware. These devices that we have are more powerful than ever and they're pocket size as ever, right? But even then, more the immersive type of hardware experiences that could potentially come out, whether they're interfaces that actually fit on your head, which I won't comment on too much, but these things that could potentially kind of provide a more immersive, rich experience. I think it's note mentioning that those things are just around the corner. They already exist today, but probably even more so now more than ever. So when hardware is there, and you think about just overall where software is and where we have high fidelity experiences and the fact that bandwidth is at a point where we can really be able to kind of tap into some of these services. You see this with streaming right now. If you think about like Microsoft's xCloud, right? You have like in Google Stadia, you have these services that can now play immersive type of game, high fidelity type of game experiences without the need to do probably too much of a client side install, right? So when you take those two considerations and then you finally add one other layer, that layer being this this transformational layer that can actually allow for people to own digital content, not through a centralized platform, that content can actually be, I'll choose my words carefully, liberated. I'm going to use that word, liberated from a platform to be able to allow you to be able to take ownership of it and freely at your own will decide to buy, sell, and trade it. That's also another component to all this, right? So when you see these three things come together, what you really have is now, and it's funny because I never explained it quite like this, you now have the ability to be able to kind of visualize this new world, I'll even say that, or even new dimension. And in this new dimension, you now have the ability to potentially conduct some level of ownership, some level of like commerce, right? And yep. In this virtual world, you could stay persistent in there, not based upon an exorbitant amount of cost to do so, but at a cost where basically like it's to a point where now it's almost as if you are streaming through this thing. What you really have then is you really have the opportunity to potentially take your, I guess your, like what you consider to be your real world existence and potentially transport it or teleport it to what's considered to be an open internet or an open metaverse. To me, it's like the evolution of what potentially is going to be new content on the internet. And I'll take it even a step further than that. Where we're at today, it's kind of in some ways it's very eye opening. And I commented about this with several other people. I've tested it for the last like few days. I want to use it on your show, so I'm happy to do it right now. I feel that more than ever now, Miko, the internet is smaller. It is smaller today than it was before. It's interesting because if you think about it, if I told you that your internet experience was like seven websites, would you believe me? If we just rattled off seven websites, that is now our internet experience, right? And I don't need to name what those websites are on this show, but I'm pretty sure it doesn't take a lot for people to figure out, wait a second, I do my shopping where? I do my social presence is where? And when you think about that, you think about like if you back things up to like 20 years ago, I would make the assessment that the internet then, people used to surf the internet. And what is surfing the internet today? No one browses the internet that I know. Do you browse the internet? No, a lot of it's usually going to a centralized website or a centralized application. And then people will link out from there to different things to see. But everything is somewhat curated. Everything is like, and everything is, if not there, then it's in search somewhere where you're going to go out there and find. Yep. And what I believe is happening with this idea behind the metaverse is you're seeing a lot of more content creation happening with decentralized applications across a distributed Web3 environment. And I think that will inspire what I consider to be this like open exploration of an open metaverse. I think is definitely something that we have not seen in a while. There hasn't been this like this wild, wild west stage of the internet for a while. And I think that's the part that excites me. But I also think that is the start of what I believe is the real metaverse. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you go back to periods in history where there's been this kind of like, obviously people have used the Cambrian explosion, which is sort of the invention of multicellular life. But obviously the other kinds of things are like the Renaissance, right? And like, in a sense, if you think about things like the rise of Protestantism, you know, which is about kind of removing intermediaries, right? So it's really about kind of like, okay, you know, this... the experience of divinity is mediated through a mechanism, right? And the question becomes, you know, is that institution needed, right? And can people get a direct experience, right? So in a sense, like, you know, another hallmark of that in history was the rise of alternative music, right? Signified by the band Nirvana, right? So, you know, I just feel like, Nirvana, they created alternative music, which was outselling popular music, right? So the alternative is more popular than the popular, right? So in a sense, like, when does that occur? And I think it occurs when the traditional institutions are no longer trusted, right? So if the traditional institutions have kind of overstayed their welcome, you know, then revolution begins, right? So I think that's kind of the tenor of what I think we're seeing. And the cycle is definitely a deep part of history, you know, and I think what's happening now is that people are wanting to shift their institutional trust into things that are more like math, right? Like they want to trust some fabric, and they want to trust things that are kind of code, and you know, those are, because they're much more predictable.
And to me, it's when you say that, like, and you talk about kind of that, what could potentially happen there with tech, like, it pauses me to think about, like, in the event, like, when we think about the internet and where it is today and what potentially could be this open metaverse, like, what are the kind of the regulations that typically nation states, not to bring the conversation back to nation states, but if you think about, like, what potentially could be waiting for them in the future, right? I make this kind of like the saying that I use usually, and it makes a lot of sense to me, and it may make other people bristle, but I think for the longest time, like, we've really enjoyed an internet as a goods and service that's free on the most part, but we've done very little to free the internet. And what I mean by that is that when I look at technology and where technology shines at its best is when it's limited regulation and the technology can grow to what it needs to be. That's human innovation, in my opinion. And I feel like at the end, when you have like potentially like some sort of external force trying to keep technology under control or under some level of watchful eye, it's difficult to kind of like ask yourself at the end, like, how much of that is being a good citizen and how much of that is going to stifle technology. And I'm not saying that it's one or the other. It's not an extreme, but I think that's where we need to continue to be mindful about the progression of what's considered to be regulation having to do with the internet. And at the same time, what has to do with like overall forward progress of technology. That's another show for you, Matt, because I think Apple, to a certain degree, is a part of that as well. I think they just stopped sales of like iPhones and of like retail locations within Russia. So different, didn't mean to segue there again, but like it is worth thought. And when I think of metaverses, I do think along those lines as well. Like, imagine if like there was an open metaverse, and in this open metaverse that isn't exposed to what's happening in the real world, you had two people meet up, and these people were friends on the metaverse for the last 3 years, and one happens to be Ukrainian and the other one happens to be Russian. They did not know until today. Do they stop being allies in this metaverse that they've been in for like 3-4 years just because all of a sudden these nations are at odds, right? It's interesting that when we look at kind of like this idea behind nation states potentially having to be reevaluated, reassessed on whether or not they're really what they should be today, that in reality, like in a metaverse, like, does any of that really matter? And how much does it matter, right? As much as the constraints of like what is the metaverse represents, right? In other words, if it's a music metaverse, does it really even matter? I don't know, probably not. So yeah.
I mean, I think I think to me, what you're kind of poking at is you're sort of poking at the idea of kind of how the metaverse frees people from geographic constraint, right? And I think that this freedom is very interesting, right? Because I've been thinking about sort of the idea of like state actors, right? And when you think about the creation of state actors, right, in a sense, what you have is this kind of open alternative, right? Which is sort of like online, effectively tribal consent-based identity realities, mm-hmm. right? That now actually have subsumed 3 out of the 4 functions of a state actor, right? Which is the three out of the four functions is that these entities now print money, right? The entities levy taxes, right? But they levy taxes, yes, on a purely consensual basis, right? And then the third function that they do is they provide governance of their own structure, right? And then obviously the fourth function that they are not able to do is they're not able to monopolize the use of force over a territory, right? Because there's no jurisdictional, there's no precedent for any kind of a, you know, metaverse to be able to do anything of the sort, you know, which we're thankful for, right? So to me, the thing that I think becomes so interesting about the idea of citizenship or belonging is that we're kind of attempting to sort of decouple citizenship from geography, right? And when we do that, we sort of force nation states to compete for our citizenship, right? So in a sense, like, you know, like obviously our physical existence is subject to taxation based on geography, but increasingly we're seeing geographies compete for people's you know, presence and their participation, right? So a lot of people are moving to places like Puerto Rico or places like Portugal, or, you know, because they like it better and they're establishing residency there. So like, you know, so I think, you know, the we're moving into a definitely a novel time frame.
Yeah, and I think overall, like if your involvement is more time consumed by spending time in a metaverse like scenario versus actually being involved way too much in like the what's considered to be the power and influence of nation states. Like, I do wonder like where all that goes. I don't have a notion either way or bias here. I think it's overall just something to like think about is we continue to approach this idea behind what if one day a metaverse is generating more what we consider to be GDP than a nation state, rivals that of a nation state. I mean, then you're like, wait a second, like, would it then in that situation, is it really something that a nation state would wage war on another, like, another nation state in the real world? But in reality, what they should be doing is they should be finding a way to conquer this metaverse and get a piece of that. So what does that even look like?
I think that's already occurred, right? And what I mean by it's already occurred is that, you know, one of the things I say about the current government of China is that they both understand the power of centralization, and they also understand what a revolution looks like. So if you kind of look at it that way, their banning of Bitcoin is essentially an attempt to exert that kind of monopolistic control over sovereignty.
Yeah.
Right. So I think it's already happened. I'm certainly not saying that Bitcoin is a larger economic nation than China. Like, it's obviously not the case. But what I'm saying is that that war has occurred, right? Like, that and the virtual nation have come to odds, and the real nation has exerted its, you know, and obviously that illegality is backed by violence and prisons, right? So if so eventually, if you continue to persist in this behavior, the Chinese government will take care of you.
They'll disconnect you from the metaverse. It does make a lot of sense. And then I usually hear this idea behind governments intervening with technology in that regards, it goes back to what we said earlier, which is then there comes a point where what we need to ask ourselves is, do we want kind of like a nerfed version of the internet then? Because when I think about the internet, I think about how powerful it potentially is as a technology and how much it's transcended things for us. Are we really talking about nation states getting more actively involved, like China saying, look, we're going to ban these following pieces of elements of what we consider to be part of the goods and services that are on the internet, on web. And these are the things we just won't do. So the moment we do that, out of respect for any nation state, I understand it's within their right to do those things. I'm not looking to say, hey, we should rise up and challenge that. I'm just saying that by doing so, there is definitely a repercussion. And the repercussion is that, like, yeah, that's an area that we may not explore anymore, or we're not encouraged to explore. And as a result, have we somewhat limited our own innovation? I do wonder about that.
Go ahead.
Oh no, go right ahead. I was gonna change the topic, but
please go ahead, change the topic.
I was gonna say that when I think about just overall metaverse, getting back on track with what we're talking about, I do see something that I think we had originally talked about but I didn't really comment on earlier, which is this idea behind tremendous job creation. I do want to comment on that because I think it's massive. When a lot of people look at kind of like the current NFT landscape, I think I've heard too many of these like Twitter talks where basically people are speculating on the value of NFTs at any given moment on any given day and talking about like a bubble. I think sometimes that's great. And I think that speculation is good for the industry and that like there's a lot of people that are very, very passionate about wanting to get involved. And I don't want to stop anyone from getting involved in like wanting to learn more about NFTs and this idea behind digital artwork. I do think that the part that I try to remind people about is that since it's so early innings, where I think NFTs will be probably the most potent, or this idea behind digital ownership, will be the fact that overall, I do look at our society right now, what I realize is that a lot of our society, there are certain types of roles within our society that get paid really well, get rewarded really well. And there's other types of roles that I think in our society that like weren't as lucrative as before. And one area that I think it's going to be very, very lucrative is going to be in creator economy. So anything to do with content creation, whether you're an artist, in an analog framework that will now pick up your first digital pen and buy your first iPad to start learning how to sketch or learning how to draw, or maybe past artists or past creators that were somewhat disenchanted with the fact that you could not necessarily make a decent amount of money doing so. I think all that has just changed with this idea behind, again, tokenization of digital content that you would own that you can now sell on the internet. And I do believe in that regards, when you think of it that way, like has the internet kind of turned the corner in terms of devising a way to create this anti-piracy software layer? Sure, why not? I'm going to go there. I think we kind of have, right? Maybe not to the point where it polices itself, but beyond a reasonable doubt, you don't need two IP patent lawyers arguing the fact of when exactly this was actually formed and created on the internet. That's powerful. Powerful enough that I believe that I would go as far as saying that digital content creation could be one of the biggest job sources in terms of like overall the amount of people we're going to need, also the amount of pay they're going to be able to command in the future. I do believe that a metaverse can only be created not by, I mean, one can make the argument that Facebook come in with Meta and create their own metaverse. I have an argument that's quite different than that. I believe that the best metaverse that we're going to experience is one that, again, is open, and the content creation is coming from the people that actually really enjoy the experience. It's got to be a passion from inside here that creates this amazing, immersive, like, content. And I think when I talked about this, I really talked about the way we look at exploration. In a way, I feel like exploration is kind of like not necessarily at the forefront of mankind, because the main reason why is this, is because we just can't leave this planet on the most part, unless we're Richard Branson or Elon Musk. We're all not going to design a rocket ship and go to Mars. Like, this is going to take some time. So that exploration itch that's part of instinctual about human nature, that curiosity, has been a bit stifled. And I think it's stifled because like those opportunities are just not there anymore. But I do think, as much as like I would love to think that a lot of job opportunities are out there in terms of us being able to explore outer space, the reality is that the next 5-10 years that I see and what I'm trying to actualize in terms of capitalizing these different types of Web3 type of gaming things is I see an exploration of the inner space, that being the human mind. That creativity, for the first time, we'll be able to unlock in a very, very big way. And what's in here in terms of creativity that we have, that other part of our society that I feel like sometimes does not get as much attention, will now be able to kind of be in full immersive type of digital experiences that are part of an unlimited canvas of exploration that we're going to be able to do. That's the future of the internet. That's the future that I would like to see. Not just one about 7 websites, but of 7 million type of experiences I can go explore throughout this digital internet galaxy, right? That I think is going to be where we're going to see a lot of job creation, especially with those that are wise enough out there to start building creator tools that will activate that. So it allows anyone to create, using any type of device to create. I'm not going to name the device manufacturer that I think would be great to create these things on, but to me, it's like, that's what really strikes me as being the most amazing thing about this. We can not only find a way to potentially create this new sort of existence, but this sort of existence also comes with massive opportunity for those that are willing to go out there and embrace it and give it a try. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the last time we spoke, I really got a strong feeling about this concept of kind of like integrity, right? Which is that in a sense, when you talk about things like IP rights, or you think about things like royalties, or you think about things like, you know, this kind of economic energy, right? The thing that's so intriguing about the internet is, you know, we're headed for an internet with like 5 billion humans on it, you know, and a planet that has 8 billion humans on it. And so the thing that's so interesting is what's happened to the kind of copy-paste internet is that the copy-paste internet, Web 2, is basically kind of just driving the value of everything to zero, right? So it's really all about kind of grinding individuals to dust and kind of making them their pointless and meaningless, right? So in a sense, if you look at gaming, if you look at Web2 gaming is really all about making you feel like you're super special, but actually making you insanely unspecial, right? Which is you've been utterly commoditized onto a spreadsheet, and you're just this retention number, right? That's all you are, right? But the thing that I think is exciting about Web3 is that Web3 actually has the potential to make individuals actually special, right? Like you could actually be, like you could be a one of one, right? So.
Well, even further than that, I'll take it a step further. When you look at streaming technology, like there was a time where everyone probably thought like the future is streaming, right? But if you think about streaming just overall, you'll get the creators and artists that are on these streaming platforms, or even developers, indie developers or major developers that are on streaming platforms. I would argue that most of them are not really making that much money. That in fact, only like a top content providers are really making enough to make it really worth it. And everyone else is just getting pummeled to death, like you said, on a $9.99 subscription. Somehow that's got to feed everyone, right? Yep. I feel like in that regards, like, is streaming where it should be at? I would argue that streaming does provide a value, obviously, and it's an infinite value to those that engage in it. But I would also make the argument that something kind of gets lost with streaming. I think the area that gets lost with streaming is this idea behind collecting. Being able to access like very unique, special experiences. There was a time when, obviously, before all the streaming technology came along, and even before like the internet and all this other stuff, that if you were at probably like an amazing concert venue like Woodstock back in the day, there was definitely a tie-in with the fact of being there in that moment. And I do think that in a way, like, I know this sounds crazy, but I'll go out there and say it. I think streaming is where it's at right now. And I think we've seen some amazing things happening in streaming. I think there's something to be said about some of those interactive entertainment experiences coming back in a very intimate way. Very much like a special experience for a special like group of people that probably identify with it, that can go out there and engage with that experience. And not only that, but willing to pay a lot more for that immersive experience that they feel is a lot more intimate with that artist or creator.
I have been thinking a lot about that, and I've been thinking a lot about sustainability and value capture. You're talking about kind of UGC, and you're talking about kind of this idea. Like, I think the future of work is kind of working to delight others, right? And the thing that I think is so interesting about kind of scaling is if you look at things like celebrities and things like sports marketing, right? Like, you can imagine, like, you know, if you see the box seats at the Super Bowl, right, it's kind of full of athletes and celebrities, but also it's full of like wealthy individuals, right? Now, in a sense, like when you think about sustainability and value capture, like, you know, I think you're talking about experiences that are very much akin to standing in front of someone who's sort of famously skillful or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that person, you can relate to them in a very feeling. The feeling is like a private setting, right? And so that to me, I think can be of super high value, right? Like that's what people want.
Well, I mean, you kind of see this already happening with, like, if you think about Epic and Fortnite and what they ran with Marshmello when they did that special interactive show. Yep. And then you see it replicated again in Roblox when they did something very similar with Nas X as well, the Old Town Road. So I think if you think about these experiences, they're fascinating to me because it's not just you picking up the song and streaming it on your device, right? Now you actually have access to this experience where they're playing the exact same songs, digitally mastered as well, right? It's the exact same song. It's not like the artist is going out there, especially with like digital music. There's a bit of a play button that you press and then it happens, but it's now more of an immersive interactive experience, and people are willing to pay what's considered to be a digital ticket price to even enjoy it. If not offered for free, for the fact that it could lead to even more of a virality to it. I do think that there is something there. There is something that streaming is not doing that that you can only get in a more like intimate setting. And that's the thing about what I realized, at least when I've been in interactive for as long as I've been in interactive now for, humans just overall, like we really do enjoy consuming digital content, but in different ways. It isn't just like, oh, it's gotta be streaming or it's gotta be, I gotta pay for these things. I wanna own them, right? But we all have our different ways of wanting to enjoy these experiences. And that level of interactivity to me is almost like a dial. Some of them I like to dial all the way in. If you told me that Daft Punk was gonna do a digital concert out there on the internet, I can't imagine how much I'd be willing to pay to experience that at least once. It's massive for me, right? So in a way, the value capture is there for, I think, any artist or creator. What it really boils down to is, like, again, like, what is the best way to capture that value? And I guess my recommendation is you have many different outlets to do so now. It's not just streaming. It's not just NFTs. If I was an artist, I would try all of them. I'd experiment with my fan base. I experiment with the people that know my artistic style, and see exactly what potentially is out there right now. But I think if there's a time to be an artist or creator, this is like the best, man. Like, I can't think of another time that now they have the opportunity to take control of their business and really make it their business and really be able to drive people to something that's just beyond, several different internet sites on the web. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think in a way, again, it kind of comes back to that theme of disintermediating the institution, right? So in a sense, like when you think about like a Spotify, right, the amount of kind of like suction of energy and power from the artist, you know, it's absolute, right? So in a sense, this copy-paste internet has kind of drained away the value of anything that anyone's done, you know? So I think, you know, we're definitely excited about this. So I guess on a closing note, like, I guess, you know, what are you excited to see upcoming? What, you know, what kind of things are you focused on in your investment practice? Like, you know, what are the things that, you know, you're looking for?
Yeah, I think right now, like when I look at kind of Mechanism Capital and where we're at right now with Web3 gaming, one, we're super like bullish on Web3 gaming just overall, just mainly because when I look at it, it's really, to me, it's just scratching the surface on this idea behind, again, this immersive metaverse, right? So in terms of areas that I'm most excited about, I'd say anything that has to do with like creator economies. So anything that has to do with that, I'm pretty excited about. So anything that creates things like that, even things that have to do more along the lines of like the, what I consider to be more along the lines of like fan culture type stuff. We made an investment called Sokol. It's the Irene Dao. So Irene Zhao, who made Irene Dao, has her own like project. So we cut a check there. And I like that just because whenever I like go on Instagram, I wonder, like, you have all these Instagram models out there. They make like nothing. And here they are on Instagram. All this content, like, it's really well curated by them, right? These are people that are on Instagram that obviously would love to be able to kind of like popularize or be able to kind of showcase kind of their life in terms of what they've created. And I think in that regards, like, people follow that, but you can't really monetize off that effectively. I think where Sokol kind of scratches that itch is somewhere between Instagram and OnlyFans to be able to kind of allow that bridge to happen, but in a very tasteful way, right? That's number one. And the number two one is this other investment we made in this gaming company that makes a game called Shrapnel. And I highly, highly suggest that you check it out. It's a shooter game. Specifically, when you look at this genre, shooter games do, they're very much within what we consider to be mainstream gaming. But this was a blockchain-enabled game based upon a gaming mechanic inspired by another gaming mechanic from another game called Escape from Tarkov. I don't know if you know Escape from Tarkov or what it is. It's based upon a setting of, it's a battle royale game like PUBG in that regards. Like, everyone shows up on a map. And then what happens is it's a matter of very hardcore. So it's more like realistic type of combat fighting. So you don't have like an infinite amount of ammo that you can fire at someone else. Like, you collect the things that you need. And the objective isn't necessarily to kill everyone or to eliminate everyone from the map. It's to escape the map. And when you escape the map, you get to keep whatever gear you had. And that becomes tokenized NFTs.
That's
so the idea that's is really whatever fun. Gear that you keep, there's buy, sell, and trade. You're always trying to upgrade your gear to drop back in a map to do it again. So what I love about that is I love about the fact that, like, now you're talking what's considered to be more like mainstream gaming, something that's relatable to a lot of people that play in this space, but now adding this element of NFTs, but in a way isn't where it's just like slapped on. Because I think you see a lot of that happening where you have gaming, free to play gaming companies slapping on blockchain, and then you have these crypto native companies slapping on a game. And both of these things, when I look at this Venn diagram, like, I want to push them together to the point where it's all going to be one thing. And I think that'll happen as the market continues to get more and more savvy with how to approach both. But as of right now, like, that's the thing is that, like, I think with Shrapnel, it's not necessarily a game that's slapping on NFTs. It's definitely a game that's thought out both the game itself, but also the token economy. So it's really, really cool. So I think those two are really exciting to me because they both kind of scratch that itch for me in different areas that I like to see. But overall, I think this is just a great time to be in gaming. This is really, like, as much as I thought that we were at the golden age of gaming, I think we're heading toward another, like, probably platinum age, which is going to be great. So yeah.
That's amazing. Well, really, really appreciate the time that you spent on the show. And, you know, always super exciting to talk to you.
Nico, it's an honor to be a guest on our show. Really appreciate your time as well. And yeah, definitely for all the people that actually tune in, really appreciate your time today listening in. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.